Niall Quinn is with us on Premier League Live. Good afternoon, Niall.
Yeah, you too, Michael. Thanks for having me.
The Arsenal you joined 30 years ago as a teenager, Niall, was a very different place to what it is nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I try and measure the difference, I only have to look as far as lunchtime as a young player, where they gave us tokens to go down the fish and chip shop for chips, fish and a can of Tango. We used to have that every day and then go back and train in the afternoon. And when you see where, you know, sports science has gone, and the football club where Arsene Wenger has brought it, the new stadium, the success since I was there, you know, it's a whole different place. But at the same time, Highbury was a very special place, still fondly remembered by fans, young and old. And I would never swap it. I know people talk about the money that's in the game now, but I had an education. There was an ethos at the club as a young player, and though many of us threatened to upset that ethos at times, Tony Adams, Paul Merson, myself, you know, we got into trouble over the years, it did give us a great grounding. And I think it was the greatest place ever to learn how to conduct yourself and be a footballer. And I suppose I'll never forget the motto Pat Rice, our youth team coach at the time, you know, used to say to us, remember who you are, where you are and whom you represent. And that was the Arsenal way, and that was the old sort of school way of doing things, but that's the way I came through, and I've huge fond memories of my time there.
The club were struggling at that time to keep up with Liverpool, Everton, and even to some extent the likes of Manchester United and Spurs. How disappointing was it then that you weren't able to stay around and play a big part in the success that George Graham would eventually bring Arsenal?
Yeah, it was a wrench to leave in many respects, but I'd had a tough couple of years as understudy to Alan Smith, who had a brilliant time, never got injured, never got a yellow card. So, you know, he wasn't even suspended. And it was very frustrating because there weren't six subs or seven subs coming on in those days, and it was one, two at the most. And it was difficult, you know. The reserve games were also played the same time as first team games. If the first team were away, it generally meant the reserve teams played at home. So if you were travelling and you weren't on the bench, I was neither playing in the reserves nor the first team. And I was trying to get in the Irish squad for the World Cup in 1990, you know, we'd qualified. And, you know, I asked George to let me go. I'd asked him a year earlier, but this particular time he agreed to it. I went to Man City, who were second bottom of the league. Didn't look a great move on paper, but I think I got my seat on the plane to Italy because of it. I did well in the last few months. We stayed up, and I soon forgot about Arsenal.
When you left City, it was Sunderland for you for a memorable 6 years, and you've made it very obvious over the years since then what a special feeling you had for the club. What was it about Sunderland, though?
Okay, so, you know, they played Hull a couple of weeks ago. They lost 1-0 at home. They've won one trophy since 1937, and there was 42,000 people at the game. You know, it's just a very, very special footballing place. The people are tough. They expect grit, heart, determination. They expect you to go for every ball. They don't do the fancy Dan who doesn't get stuck in. And for some reason, I suppose, that suited me. I got injured. I had a bad injury. Did my cruciate in the first year. I was looking if I was going to be a flop there. I got a lot of stick off them, you know, perhaps rightly so. And I think I appreciated it more when I won them over and saw, you know, what it meant to them and how they supported me then and making me the player I became at Sunderland, because I got better with age, there's no doubt about that. And also, of course, Kevin Phillips walked in the door, so we had a great partnership. And Sunderland fans, you know, they're different. They really are. As I said, they haven't won a lot. But what the club means to them is just enormous. And when you have a city that has 300,000 people and 42,000 come to watch them, you know, playing Hull, and we had like 37,000 at championship games, it really means that every home virtually is involved. Every house is involved. Business leaders will tell you that when Sunderland win Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, productivity is really high in the business sector. When we lose, or when Newcastle beat the club, you know, people weren't turning up for work on the Mondays. It was that serious. And when you buy into that and you live off it and you thrive off it, and when you get a great living out of it, and when they propel you to a place for it, you know, of course it was a better experience for me than anything at Man City or Arsenal.
When Liverpool drew at West Brom in February, they were 8 points off the lead and seemingly no longer a factor in this season's title race. Then they won their next 9 matches. But it was the 10th which really convinced people that the Reds could just be champions.
Oh, it's a ball clearance by Company. It's a chance. Oh, it's a brilliant goal from Philippe Coutinho for Liverpool. Brendan Rodgers is on the pitch celebrating And every single Liverpool supporter is jumping up and down in delight. It's Liverpool 3, Manchester City 2.
An 11th straight win followed at Norwich on Easter Sunday. But everything started to change the weekend after that.
Oh, there's a big save by Gerrard, and Denver Barr's picking up at the halfway line. He's one-on-one with Mignolet, and Denver Barr has scored for Chelsea. It's an incredible goal, and in a silenced Anfield, every single Chelsea outfield player comes to celebrate with Barr in front of the cup.
So Liverpool were already on the back foot when they went to Crystal Palace, where a calamitous late collapse left Manchester City very much in control. And two nights later, City pounced to go top of the table.
Yaya Toure is going past everybody. Toure is inside the penalty area, and Toure scores a beautiful goal. He runs half the length of the field. He shrugged off a couple of Aston Villa challenges in stoppage time at the end of this game. It's Manchester City 4, Aston Villa 0.
So it's all in City's hands going into this afternoon's match at home to West Ham. But don't forget that 2 years ago, this happened.
Goal! It is a goal, would you believe? Jamie Mackey has scored for Queen's Park Rangers. And suddenly, the title is disappearing from the grasp of Manchester City.
Before this happened.
A chance and a goal! Aguero has scored for Manchester City, and he has won them the title.
So maybe there's still time for one final twist. Liverpool certainly hope so. City could live without it. But what we do know is that by 5 o'clock, one of them will be Premier League champions. Good afternoon, I'm Michael McMullen, and for the last time this season, it's Premier League Live with Sky Sports. On the face of it, there's a sense of inevitability about Manchester City winning the title this afternoon, but then who would have seen them failing to win at home to Sunderland? Indeed, who would have seen Sunderland winning at Chelsea? Or even Liverpool emerging as real title contenders at all this season? If there's one thing which has been underlined more than ever in this campaign, it's the simple old maxim that you just never know.
Thanks, Graham. So, goals going in. All of them, remember, 3 o'clock kickoffs. No goals so far, though, at Anfield. Liverpool 0, Newcastle 0. And no goals here either. Let's go to Anfield, see what's happening there. Ian Beach.
Well, we just had a goal disallowed in a roundabout way, Ron. It is still Liverpool 0, Newcastle 0. Luis Suarez took a free kick very quickly from wide on the right wing. He had been the man fouled, and he just almost sprung to his feet and took it first time on the outside of his right. But as I speak, actually, Newcastle have scored. Would you believe it? I think it's an own goal. They burst down the left-hand side, pulled it back to the edge of the six-yard box, and it's gone in off a Liverpool player's shin, perhaps Martin Skrtel. So developments here. It's Liverpool 0, Newcastle 1.
Thanks, Ian. Well, perfect timing to go over to Anfield. A wrong sort of score for Liverpool supporters at the moment. Liverpool 0, Newcastle 1. And here we have a corner kick to Manchester City. Still 0-0 here.
It's all happening out in front of them. It's actually a back line of six with the two wingers Downing and Diami there, the three in the middle with Matt Taylor, Noble and Nolan.
Now then, Nasri drives and scores! Sami Nasri from 20 yards hits a cracking right-footed shot. Well, it needed something unexpected, and we got something unexpected. Sami Nasri with his right foot. Wonderful shot. Adrian just got a fingertip to it. It hit the inside of the post, into the net. Deadlock broken. Manchester City 1, West Ham United 0.
Well, it was all out in front of the West Ham defence until Nasri picked it up in a bit of space. He still had a lot to do. He left live his right foot from the left-hand side of the penalty area, and it flew in between a few West Ham players, hit the bottom of the post. Adrian couldn't quite get there.
Listen to this roar now, because it's Yaya Toure who goes up to receive his medal. He is a giant of a man in every respect. Had to come off with an injury today, but his contribution has been immense. Yaya Toure, 20 Premier League goals from midfield. Sergio Aguero is next up. Aguero, 17 Premier League goals in just 20 starts. He was injured for much of the season, so his contribution in terms of goals has been wonderful. And remember, this team scored 102 Premier League goals throughout the season, just one short of Chelsea's record.
Yeah, I think 156 in all competitions, Ron. That averages out nearly 3 goals a game, which is unbelievable.
Well, now, the big moment, because the captain, Vincent Kompany, arrives, collects his medal, and with everyone behind him, he waves everyone back, and there it is! There it is! The championship trophy, the Premier League trophy, is held aloft. There go the fireworks, there go the rockets. It is a wonderful, wonderful sight. Practically everyone has stayed in the stadium. A sea of blue, of course, and the players jumping up and down. Kompany holding the trophy aloft. Pellegrini is in there somewhere. Manuel Pellegrini, the manager. He will be delighted in his own quiet, dignified way. He really has done a fantastic job here.
All these years later, here we are, Eamon, talking about another book, which I've been reading over the last few days. One of the things that comes through is a lot of anger and a lot of what might be described as cynicism about a lot of things. Is that fair?
Well, I'm certainly not a cynic, because if you're a cynic, you don't get angry, you get even. I'm not a cynic.
But are you angry about a lot of things?
Yeah, I'd be a skeptic, which is a different thing.
That's a better word, actually.
Yeah, I am passionate. I'm not really angry or bitter, but I'd be very passionate about injustice and things that are wrong. And when I was playing soccer, there was a lot of injustice to players. When I was growing up, I witnessed a lot of injustice.
Well, I was going to say, a lot of people who feel that way and, you know, have strong views on injustice, it goes back to maybe some of their own experiences.
Yes,
but was there some experience of yours that, you know, created that sense of injustice in you?
Yeah, we were poor growing up, and a lot of people are poor today and were in my time. And, you know, the man in the suit puts the boot into you, whether he's a lawyer, banker, doctor, priest, the powerful people put the boot into poor people. And I was in that category, and that was a formative experience. My family we were threatened with eviction, my father was unemployed. So all of that gives you a perspective on the world that's, you know, it's not cynical, but it's certainly, you can see injustice when it's staring you in the face. And it makes you want to do something about it, at least to confront it in some way. And I would say I'm confrontational. When I see a man in a suit and he wants to push people around or me, then I confront him.
And I think it's fair to say the moment when that confrontational style really became a sort of mainstream talking point across the country was your very public row with Jack Charlton in 1990. Now, anyone reading the book who wasn't around then might think it's been exaggerated, but those of us who can remember 23 years ago know it really was just as big a deal as you make it out to be in the book. And you've written a lot about the impact it had on you and your family at that time.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was having a great time. Everyone who didn't know football or love football, which is quite a small community in Ireland in those days, were having a good time. People were having barbecues, partying with their neighbours. It was very nice, actually. I mean, it was like winning the Eurovision every day.
Which Jack, we did in those days anyway.
We did anyway, yeah. But Jack took us to places we'd never been before. And my head was fixed on football analysis, and the football was quite crude, and the 1990 World Cup actually was the worst ever. FIFA changed the rules afterwards because it was so awful. So I was saying the king has no clothes, and I was spoiling the party, and people resented that. They thought I was contriving to be controversial and making it up, but I was actually thinking about the football side of it. But football and sport in general, you know, it's only part of life, and people were having a great time. And there was a mob, and they were quite an angry mob.
Tell us, Eamon, if you would, just about some of the things that you talk about in the book, some of the experiences you had at that time.
Well, I had a lot of bad experiences. One experience, Michael, which I came out of the Westbury Hotel, and there's a taxi rank there, and there's 5 taxis on that rank. And I was looking for a taxi, and the 5 guys said, "Bugger off, we're not taking you." Well, can you imagine that? I mean, it's really kind of awesome. But at the airport, when I came home from Italia 90, just an hour before the team was due to arrive, a mob closed in on my car and wanted to turn it over. Well, half of them wanted to turn it over, half of them said leave it alone. And that was actually quite scary, because there were no guards there and lots of people had taken drink. My kids were bullied, and my family didn't like the idea that their son or husband or father was a national hate figure, which I was for a little while, because people thought I was messing, you know. And I wasn't actually. I was actually writing about football.
Has any Ireland manager done the job well, in your view, Eamon, in your time
as a
pundit?
That's a good question. John Giles, I think, did it really well. He changed the whole culture. He made sure that, you know, the Blazers behaved themselves and the players were looked after. He was there for 7 years. After that, I think Mick McCarthy did a good job, Michael, but I think he was wrong in Saipan. And funny enough, Alex Ferguson's book, which is just out, proves the point that he kicked Keane out. Keane didn't walk. He kicked him out. I think Mick McCarthy did a good job. I think Trapattoni was a disaster, and I was big cheerleader for him before he came. But I know what you're getting at in your question. Is every Irish manager going to be cursed with me?
Well, it's just, you can see why people would get that impression, Eamon. And, you know, people say that you thrive on publicity and controversy and being in the spotlight, and that you tailor what you say for those objectives, and that you're inconsistent from time to time. You say something and then you say something different.
But things change, you see. I mean, I said something about Mick McCarthy 15 years ago, that he was a congenital loser. 15 years ago. That's a very long time ago. And Ireland weren't doing so well when he was at the time. But Mick McCarthy grew, changed, took us to a World Cup, screwed up in Saipan, went to Wolves, did a really great job keeping Wolves in the Premier League, I thought. And they sacked him cruelly. They dropped like a stone. They're down two divisions. I thought he took that with great dignity. I thought he's doing a good job at Ipswich. He saved them from relegation last year. So what I'm describing to you is, things change, and then you've got to adjust. If you say 15 years ago someone is a congenital loser, and then, you know, 5 or 6 years after that they prove themselves to be really classy guy, to have matured, to have changed, what are you supposed to do? Go on saying what you said a long time ago, or say, hold on, this guy's changed?
But even aside from the inconsistency thing, Eamon, I think people would look at the Noel King business recently, and people would say, was there any need to say that a guy who was brought in at short notice for two matches was out of his depth? And I think people would look at that and say, certainly, if it's not a case that you like creating publicity, Eamon, you're certainly very good at doing it.
John and Liam agreed with me about Noel King. If they start letting people into matches for nothing, and if people travel to Germany, as many Irish fans did, to support the Irish team, then they're entitled to critical analysis. They're entitled to an informed debate about what's going on. It doesn't matter if Noel King's in the job for 2 weeks or 2 days or 21 days. The Irish soccer team is of great interest to people, and how they're playing, who's playing, what system they use is of interest to people. So I thought we were obliged to treat him with respect. In other words, to treat him as if he was Trapattoni or anybody else. I don't think we were hitting on him. In fact, in the week before the match, I thought he did some really good things. He brought Andy Reid back, brought Kevin Doyle back. I wrote about that in the Star. I praised him for that. But then when I saw the team, I went, hello, what's this? What are we supposed to do? You know, the big thing about the RTE panel is it engages with the people who love soccer, totally upfront. There's no hidden agenda. It's just, we're three guys, we love football, we want to talk about it. And Noel King, you know, he gets the same treatment as everyone else. What are you supposed to do for 45 minutes before the match, Michael?
I think people felt it was a little over the top, though, to say that he was out of his depth, and, you know, to call it the worst Irish defence you'd ever seen.
Well, actually, the back four in the game in Germany was probably the worst, because the two big players,
Richard and John, were suspended.
Richard and John O'Shea. Yeah, and it was probably or maybe the worst Irish back four. What are you supposed to say?
But I think people perceived it maybe as an attack on Noel when circumstances had dictated he'd play that back four.
Some people in the media would have done that, but I haven't detected ordinary soccer fans. You know, they were debating the thing as well, at home, in the bar, with their mates. You know, people engage with sport, they debate. You know, if you look at Davy Fitz, he was nearly gone when Clare lost in the Munster final. And that was people, you know, debating, being critical, saying he picked the wrong players, saying the Clare team had the wrong style. That's what sport's about. Now, I'm part of that. We're part of that. And you engage with that.